You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, May 17th, 2006. This is your host, Stephen Novella, president of the New England Skeptical Society. Joining me this evening are Rebecca Watson.
Hey.
Bob Novella.
Thanks for joining us, everyone.
Evan Bernstein.
Good to be here, everyone.
And Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
Thanks for joining me this evening, guys.
My pleasure.
Surely.
So coming up later in the show, we have an interview with Ray Hyman. Ray is one of the fathers of modern skepticism and an ESP skeptic. We'll have a good time talking with him. But first, a couple of news items. I've been trying to get some follow-up on the Bosnian pyramid fiasco. Remember from a few episodes ago, amateur archaeologist who believes that these mountains in Bosnia are actually ancient pyramids built by the Atlanteans.
Well, Steve, don't waste your time, because Bob and I flew down there last week and took that sucker out.
You did?
Yeah, he's done.
We won't be hearing from him anymore.
Good job, guys. Good job.
Well done.
Thank you, Rebecca.
I predicted that one of our discussions was not just that his claims are absurd, you know, that these aliens came down and inhabited Atlantis and built these pyramids, but also the mainstream media was totally taken in by this.
Completely bought in.
Yeah. Hook, line, and sinker. I predicted, however, that the news cycle would eventually catch up with this. That eventually, you know, the mainstream news outlets like New York Times and CNN and BBC would figure out that this was a hoax. But, you know, it hasn't really happened yet. And I did another search today just to see what everyone was saying on it. The New York Times does have a follow-up article that's at least introducing the idea that there are some skeptics to this guy's claim.
It's still pretty bad, though.
It's still pretty bad. It's not saying, oh, it was a hoax, this guy's an idiot. National Geographic has an article saying that it's basically treating the issue as if it's controversial.
What?
And
National Geographic?
But it's pretty skeptical, but it's still presenting it as a controversy. And then Archaeology is the only one saying, wow, this guy is nuts, and how is the rest of the mainstream media buying this? But the other ones, the other outlets like CNN and MSNBC and BBC, all still have, the only articles they have on their sites on this topic is their original credulous article. So they're a little bit slow catching up to this one.
Can I say that my favorite quote from the New York Times is, largely uncritical television and newspaper reports have made the photogenic Mr. Osmanejic a national celebrity. They're complaining about the uncritical television newspaper reports, like themselves.
Like
they
themselves, right.
Reported
right.
It.
Including us.
And, of course, Osmanagic, you know, this is the amateur archaeologist. His response to all this is, although scientists are just jealous of my discoveries.
Oh, my God.
I wish I had looked at a hill and said, oh, it's pyramid-shaped. There must be a pyramid.
It's always a big clue that you're dealing, you know, with the pseudoscientists when they start disparaging the mainstream scientific community.
By saying they're jealous.
He's got to be standing at the top of, like, that pyramid hill with, like, the thunderclouds behind him and, like, doing the cackle. That I can see that.
That's in Jay's world, right? That's where that's happening.
I love it.
And, of course, you know, he's bolstering his claims by saying that they're digging up, like, real worked stone, etc. But, of course, there's, like, actual Roman and other legitimate archaeological sites on that hill that he's now trampling over. One of the archaeologists said, this is like bulldozing over Stonehenge because some kook thinks that there's some hidden treasure underneath.
Oh, my God.
So they're appropriately outraged, but the rest of the media has not caught up with that. Now, Rebecca, you sent me an item about a Mormon cult leader who's getting in trouble with the FBI. Why don't you tell us about that?
Yeah, he's hit the big time. Top 10 most wanted list, which includes Osama bin Laden, among others, now features one breakaway Mormon cult leader. Not, you know, the traditional Mormon church, but they have these sects that are fundamentalist sects, and they're the polygamous ones,
mm-hmm.
and they are really, really insane. His name is Warren Jeffs, and he has built up this cult of, we're talking like thousands of supporters, and basically he controls this whole area where his supporters are judges and police officers. He travels around with a fleet of SUVs containing his bodyguards. He's considered armed and dangerous as he's traveling around trying to avoid the FBI.
But what got him on the FBI list, other than the fact that he's paranoid and has lots of bodyguards? Is it the polygamy, or is he doing something else?
I think that it's... The polygamy includes, like, child molestation, because they're taking, you know, very young girls and brainwashing them and molesting them, you know,
and plus,
allegedly.
I hear that that this guy is marrying some of the older males of the cult to the 14-year-old girls,
oh,
the 13-year-old girls.
He set up hundreds of these weddings.
Yeah, and then
imagine?
he also randomly just takes whole families and rearranges them. He'll take the wives and children and homes from one person and just give them to another. And I was reading, I think there was an article on CNN about him where one guy came out against him, a guy who used to be in the sect but got kicked out. And the guy was talking about, oh yeah, what a nut this guy is. And then they go on to say that that man got his seven wives taken away from him or something.
Yeah, this poor guy.
It's like, yeah.
Well,
aww.
You know, if he had seven wives, he should have kept his mouth shut.
Yeah.
You know what I'm talking about?
Well, that's the whole point. I mean, they use wives as a perk to keep people in line and also to keep you loyal.
Yeah, and presumably this guy who's now a detractor of Jeff's, you know, he was fine when he had his seven wives, but Jeff's took them away, and so now he's running to the media. So it's a really creepy call, and I think that they're reaching this point where it's going to turn into a disaster if it's not.
You think it's like a Waco, Texas kind of
Branch
thing?
Branch Davidians.
You know, yeah, you think of all of the major headline-grabbing cults of the past few years. I mean, this is going to be up there. It's huge. He's got like 10,000 supporters, and I mean,
wow. They
believe the craziest stuff. You know, it's scary. So that was kind of a downer.
Yeah, well, it's interesting to talk about these cults. And again, it all gets back to human psychology.
Yeah.
And, you know, how can they, you know, brainwash people into believing the kooky stuff that they believe and, you know, adopting these bizarre lifestyles? It's a experiment in human frailty. We have our usual steady stream of emails coming in, which we always appreciate. I'm going to read a few this week. The first email comes from David O'Donovan from Dublin, Ireland. David O'Donovan.
he says,
hi, guys. I just, any excuse to give a cheesy accent.
Of course.
First off, I just like to say that I really enjoy the podcast. I'm always fascinated by the paranormal, and I happened to come across your podcast by accident while searching iTunes. What a great show. I've realized that I'm also fascinated by the skeptic's point of view, and although I really like the idea of a paranormal universe, it's nice to get a slap of reality from you guys. Keep up the good work.
I like that, a slap of reality.
Maybe that should be our new byline.
Yeah.
The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, a slap to the face of reality. What do you think?
Yeah. I like it.
So with that in mind, I'm curious about you guys. Have you ever come across any paranormal claims that made you think twice or that you just can't explain? Well, that is kind of a standard question that paranormal investigators or skeptics get. Anything out there really vexed us. Of course, you know, the short answer to this question is always no. There really is nothing out there that is passing for paranormal that is at all interesting or that is a genuine mystery. And, you know, we've been doing this for 10 years now. You know, when you get into the field with these people, when we're doing ghost investigation or electronic voice phenomenon, or, you know, we've tested psychics and others, that it's always amazing how much more lame and pathetic they are than what you imagine them to be just from hearing about them or hearing about their claims or even talking to them. The paranormal claims are being made by people who are profoundly scientifically illiterate who really don't understand the, you know, how to think or argue logically, have an incredibly bizarre or distorted worldview, and their claims are often really childish. They're paper thin. So, you know, it's just, we're always surprised at how lame they are. We've never been surprised by how impressive the alleged phenomenon is or how solid the claims are. We're always, as skeptical and cynical as we are, we always still manage to get surprised by how absurd and ridiculous the claims are. They really are childish.
Yeah, the thing is, when I try to think of something that I find completely baffling, the only things I can think of are the edges of science that I just can't quite grasp.
Science is baffling. Science has genuine mysteries. You know, what's the ultimate structure of the universe, black holes, etc. I mean, there's lots of genuine scientific mysteries. There really are no paranormal mysteries out there. You know, you investigate, it's like, yep, that's a clear case of self-deception, you know, and as soon as you look, even take a semi-close scientific look at it, it's obvious that it's not a genuine phenomenon.
When I was young, I believed in chiropractic, but to me it was another, you know, it was another school of medicine, and, you know, it literally took Steve to go to medical school and to really, really find out. And then, you know, Steve, I remember you talking to me about chiropractic way long time ago, telling me it's bunk. And I'm like, what, chiropractic? You got to be kidding me, you know. And now, to me, you know, after doing this with you guys for so many years, nothing gets by.
Yeah, I mean, you didn't realize what the claims were all about. You thought it was just a type of physical medicine. You didn't realize that they believed in life energy coursing through your nerves and, you know, the crazy stuff that some of them believe. But let's move on to the next email. This one comes from Danny McGee from Valdez, Alaska. And Danny writes...
Danny McGee!
Not quite. Danny McGee, eh?
This one's from Alaska. Danny writes, hey guys, love the show. Listen every week. Keep up the good work. Yada, yada. On to the actual issue. Those were his yada, yadas, not mine. He says, I hear a lot of people in the skeptical scientific community talking about what crummy science education standards we have in the U.S. and how most high school textbooks water down the teaching of evolution. So I thought it might be worth noting one of the exceptions. In our small town of Valdez, Alaska, the science education is great. My girlfriend is a high school senior, and the longest chapter in her book, her biology book, is The Theory of Evolution. There's a separate chapter on human evolution. Also, it doesn't beat around the bush. In the very beginning of the chapter, it states that evolution is the single most fundamental theory in all of biology. Well, first, Danny, you can't yada yada our praises. You have to actually take the time to tell us how wonderful we are.
Don't be afraid to name names.
Okay? Yeah, Danny, those praises are what we get paid on. Right. We don't get make money on this.
We need specifics. But anyway, on to your question. Yeah, sure, there are, you know, education is a very local phenomenon. It's really controlled by local school boards. Individual schools can make textbook decisions. There can always be stellar science teachers anywhere, and they're out there. So there are plenty of exceptions. But if you look at the country as a whole, we consistently perform near the bottom in terms of science and math on standardized tests when compared to other industrialized nations. So on the aggregate, we're not doing well. Plus, I think if you just look at how scientifically illiterate the American public is, by any reasonable measure, the scientific illiteracy in this country is about 90% to 95%, which is not much lower than the number of people who are not working scientists. So basically, the only scientifically literate people in this country are working scientists, people who work in some kind of science or technology field, and then maybe a few enthusiasts. So by those standards, you know, overall we're not doing well. I did take a look after I got your question just to see what was out there in terms of assessments of high school biology textbooks. And very recently, a couple of years ago, the American Academy for the Advancement of Science, the AAAS, did an assessment of high school biology textbooks, and they said that across the board they were substandard. Across the board, they didn't find any textbooks that were being widely used that measured up in terms of the teaching of biology in general and evolution in particular. I'll have the link to their assessment on our website. However, I also found, you guys know Ken Miller?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yep. Ken Miller is the evolutionary biologist who has, in my opinion, is one of the best, if not the best, debater who confronting the intelligent design crowd today. He wrote the book Finding Darwin's God. He's an excellent speaker and writer, and he knows his stuff cold. But he wrote with co-wrote with Joe Levine a high school biology textbook, and it's, I think it's in its third edition now, and they have a website dedicated to it. Again, we'll have the link. And from what I could see from their website, it looks to be an excellent biology textbook that deals very well and very comprehensively with evolution. So they're out there. Good textbooks are out there. But it looks like from their website, only a few school districts are using their textbook. This is something that is definitely winnable. I mean, it's very, the resources to improve science education in general, evolution education in particular, exist. But unfortunately, we have to fight this battle in thousands of local, you know, school districts and school boards. You know, there's nothing you could really do on a global level to win this fight.
Well, it might take something like another Sputnik to motivate the entire country to upgrade our science education.
Yeah, we talked about this a little last week with Eugenie Scott. There, something may focus federal attention on the quality of science education, and that would help. But it still comes down to those local school boards to get the right textbooks, etc. One last quick email. This is a follow-up to our Scientology superpower topic that we talked about last week. This is from Wendy Bombardi, and Wendy writes, I looked up the article talking about the Perceptics course, but unfortunately I only found one article that everyone is linking to. Is it a reliable site? Doesn't seem like it, but great topic to discuss. Very fun. Laughed out loud. Well, Wendy, I did some follow-up research. There, if you do just an internet search or a Google search on this topic, you will come up with like the one article that that everyone then links to. Unfortunately, that's just the way things are these days. Somebody writes an article, it gets put on the AP, and then all of the news services link to it, and all the websites that talk about that topic end up linking to the same article. But I was able to find some independent resources, some of which come from Rick Ross. You might remember we had him on our show a couple months ago. Rick Ross is probably now the leading cult expert. But other sites as well that independently verify that L. Ron Hubbard did write about Perceptics, that concept comes from his writings.
Oh yeah, you can also check. It's in Dianetics.
Dianetics. So that part is real, and that there for years, Scientology has been planning this superpower, whatever facility. Now, a lot of the recent reports, and the reason why this is in the news recently, is largely from this. One, I believe, I don't know if he's a current or ex-Scientologist, who said he went through this training and to gain these super powerful perceptions. And that's the article that you're referring to. But I don't know if you did you find any other resources on that when you were searching on that topic, Rebecca?
A few. You have to, if you search for Perceptics, you have to go really deep into Google, like page 8 or 9, and then you start turning up these really weird Scientologist links that are
just
not
weird.
Yeah.
Yeah, they are.
So the bottom line is I think that this one is for real. And again, you always have to reinforce that when you're talking about what Scientologists believe, that, yep, they really believe this.
And if you go to Dianetics.org, you can learn all about Dianetics. And I think if you do a search for Perceptics on there, you'll find some sites.
So I promised last week that we would do a Name That Logical Fallacy segment, so let's do that before we go on to our interview. And actually, Rebecca, you sent this one to me. This is from Don Walton, the Time for Truth Ministries.
Oh, the Don.
The Don. So this is just a typical representation of a lot of this is more like a creation science website, not so much intelligent design. And I'm taking a couple excerpts out of what he says. He writes, isn't it amazing what today's scientists can deduce from a mere rock or dust particle? Do you remember the Genesis space capsule? Scientists assured us that this important space mission, designed to gather solar atoms, would eventually enable them to explain the origin of the universe. Unfortunately, the space capsule crashed upon its return to the Earth. Its parachute malfunctioned due to the fact that it had been put in backwards. Now, I don't know about you, but as far as I'm concerned, scientists who can't figure out which way to put in a parachute have no chance of figuring out the origin of the universe. So this should be a pretty straightforward logical fallacy. What do you guys think about that paragraph? Anyone want to bite?
Is that ad hoc?
Non sequitur.
Ad hoc reasoning?
Well, the core of it, I mean, the non sequitur is tough because really, when you think about it, all right. logical fallacies are non sequiturs. They're all subsets of non sequiturs. So, yeah, so non sequitur is kind of always the right answer, but you can get more specific than that. It's not really so much ad hoc reasoning. Yeah. It's not inventing a specific reason to explain a specific result. It's basically, this is an ad hominem. This is an ad hominem attack. So, in its broadest concept, an ad hominem, which basically means arguing against the person rather than the evidence or the logic, is when you say that someone's claims are wrong because of some negative quality they possess. And there are lots of subsets of that basic concept. Here, so this is, he's saying the scientists are wrong because right. they've made mistakes in the past.
There you go.
So this is the appeal to prior error, which is a subset of the ad hominem attack.
And there's so much more that's even wrong with that, because he's not even criticizing scientists. He's criticizing, he might think he is, but he's criticizing, you know, whoever put in a parachute on the
right.
thing.
Right, it's a technical thing. Not, right. It has nothing to do with the scientific method or the evidence for evolution or whatever.
Right.
But he goes on. He says, yet, before we throw our Bibles away, let's remember a similar claim made by evolutionists several years ago, the coelacanth, discovered in fossil remains believed by scientists to be 400 million years old, was once touted by evolutionists as the missing link, in quotes, between fish and land animals. This prehistoric creature was believed to have possessed both lungs and gills, as well as lobed fins, and a skeletal and muscular system that enables it to walk on either the ocean floor or dry land. Today, thanks to the fact that hundreds of them have been caught off the coast of South Africa, the coelacanth has been nicknamed the living fossil. This so-called living fossil has not only given evolution a black eye, but left evolutionists scratching their heads for an explanation as to why the coelacanth failed to evolve into an amphibian and has remained virtually unchanged for the past 400 million years. Of course, the coelacanth will eventually evolve, evolutionists assure us. Just give it a gazillion years or two. Wow. What, you could dig a lot out
There's
of that.
There's just so much wrong with it.
But let's get specific. Tell me what hit you? What can you dissect out of that?
It's bull.
It is bull. Well, along those lines, you know, we talk about logical fallacies, but you also have to examine the premises. And his premise about the coelacanth is completely wrong in a way.
Right. What really jumps out at me is his last sentence seems like a total straw man, saying that
yes.
Evolutionists will say that the coelacanth will evolve. Nobody's saying that, you know.
Right. That is a straw man argument. That is not the position of evolution. That a missing link is in the process of evolving into something else, yeah. and that it hasn't evolved. Therefore, evolutionists were wrong. That's a total straw man argument. That is not what evolutionists say.
And why have evolutionists ever argued a missing link of anything? They never bring that up.
Missing link is an archaic, sort of quaint concept. What we talk about are transitional fossils. And the coelacanth, you know, is transitional. Well, for all fossils, all animals and fossils, except for currently living ones, are transitional in a way. Because everything sits between two other things, you know. Even living species can be considered transitional between related species. So, but the coelacanth, you know, is a fish. It's from a, I believe it's an order of fish, maybe a family. I'm not sure about that, but it's a group of fish that does have what it was close to those fish that did evolve, you know, into land animals. That doesn't mean that the coelacanth should have evolved over time itself into amphibians. Because the creationists have this sort of linear concept of evolution. They don't understand that evolution is a branching tree or a branching bush. The false premise here is that the coelacanth has not evolved over 400 million years. Again, he's referring to a coelacanth as if it is a species. It's not. It's a higher group of fish. And the coelacanths that we discover today are not the same coelacanth fossils that are 400 million years old. For example, that would be like finding that there was a dinosaur living in the jungle somewhere. And a dinosaur is an order of reptiles. It wouldn't be, we wouldn't find a triceratops today. We would find something that is 65 million years downstream, but still within, you know, the dinosaur order. Does that make sense? So the coelacanths are many species within a group of fish. And yeah, so there are coelacanth descendants of 400-million-year-old coelacanth ancestors that group survived into modern times, but not the species.
It's like he dug up your great-grandfather's corpse and said it was you.
Right, exactly.
It's just wrong.
Steve, granted, though, there are certain species that have changed very little over extended periods of time, such as sharks and alligators. There's really very little change. And that does happen. But so what? They're well suited to their environment. How does that go against evolution?
Well, yeah, one of the things he says is that he holds up the coelacanth as the black eye. And that's the only thing that we call a quote-unquote living fossil, as opposed to things like the ginkgo tree, dogfish, the gar, hagfish, lamprey, lungfish. You know, it's like...
Yeah, there's lots of species that have not changed much, you know, they're over long periods of time. And that's because that happens in stable, outbred, large populations that are generalists. They're not highly specialized to a specific environment. They have sort of a general suite of abilities that enable them to live in many environments.
So, Steve, was he supposing that, you know, once an organism is alive, that it's on the path of evolution, and that it's, you know, it's like spinning a coin, like it's going to happen, right?
Well, but yeah, again, he says, why hasn't the coelacanth evolved? Well, that's ridiculous. I mean, first of all, the fact that it still exists doesn't mean that it can't have evolutionary descendants.
What
so that's
that
just
mean?
That's a kind of a non sequitur, and it's basically based upon a false premise about how evolution works, which also makes it a straw man argument. So often, you know, arguments can include multiple logical fallacies at the same time, and creationists are great at doing that.
I find that the straw man is the usual go-to for...
Yeah, for creationists. They can't argue against what evolutionists are really saying, because what evolutionists are saying is valid.
Right.
It's logical and based on evidence. So they have to argue against a straw man.
What logical fallacy is... Oh, yeah.
That is...
He's thinking about it.
Appeal to personal incredulity, maybe.
Yeah. Oh, Steve, yeah. I love you, man. You're the best skeptic on the planet.
You could also be... the appeal to ridicule, which is a subset of the personal incredulity argument, which is basically just saying, that's nonsense.
Yeah, but you got to say it like that. Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Well, then you too might fall into that category.
The tu quoque, you mean?
Yeah.
It's not a fallacy unless you use the Latin.
That's right.
Jay, I think that one was grasping at straw men.
Grasping at straw men.
Yeah.
All right, well, there you go. Let's go to our interview. So joining us now is Ray Hyman. Ray, welcome to The Skeptic's Guide.
Hi.
Dr. Hyman got his PhD in psychology from Johns Hopkins University and taught psychology and statistics at Harvard University. He is an expert in self and other deception, evaluating studies involving humans. He is a prominent critic of paranormal research, who wrote the definitive critique of the Ganzfeld experiments. He's the author of at least a couple of books, The Elusive Quarry, A Scientific Appraisal of Psychical Research, and you wrote with another author, Water Witching USA. You wrote that with, is that Evan Vogt?
Yeah.
Is that how you say his name?
Vogt, right.
Yeah.
Evan Vogt. We call him Evie.
Evie.
Evie Vogt.
So again, it's great to have you on The Skeptic's Guide. So let's start with the Ganzfeld experiments. We had... Marilyn Schlitz on our show a few weeks ago, and if she gave us the pro-ESP side of the Ganzfeld experiments. Of course, your name came up, but give us your summary of what you think about these experiments and what they really tell us about the reality of ESP.
Well, they tell us nothing about the reality of ESP. They tell us a lot about the psychology of parapsychologists.
Right.
The real problem is with the field as a whole, of course. But the original Ganzfeld experiments were started, I think the first one was published about 1970s, I think in the early 70s, yeah. By the time, early 1980, I was asked by two different sources to do something about parapsychology. For example, the IEEE journal, you know, that's the international, for the electronic engineering journal. They had, were going to publish, and then they did publish, an article by Robert John, which created a lot of problems. Robert John was then the dean of applied and sciences and engineering at Princeton University. He's still there, and he runs what's called the Princeton Engineering Anomalies Research Laboratory. So he did a long article on his research and parapsychology as a whole, which was rather positive.
Mm-hmm.
And that created enough commotion. The editors contacted me and asked if I would write what they called a tutorial on ESP, sort of to balance the
proponents.
Yeah, to give the other side of the issue, more or less. So I did ultimately a very long article for them. But at the same time, this is the early 80s, I was asked to participate in the 100th anniversary of the founding of the Society for Psychical Research. 1882 is when they founded it. In 1982, the Parapsychological Association and the Society for Psychical Research, which still exists, decided to have a big celebration, 100th anniversary celebration, at Cambridge University in England. And as part of that celebration, they decided to have one whole day devoted to skeptics.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to have a skeptic from each continent, and I represented the United Americas, I guess.
Nobody celebrates skeptics. Who celebrates skeptics?
And they had Susan Blackmore represent, I guess, England, and then they had some skeptics from other places.
Who was Antarctica?
Yeah. I don't know who had represented Antarctica, but we had about... I don't know, maybe five or six of us, and we had an all-day session where we presented the skeptical viewpoint. And so to prepare for that, I decided, hey, you know, I can't read every... You know, the one problem that critics of parapsychology have created is that most critics, including my good friends like Martin Gardner and Randy and so on, you know, attack parapsychological research without having even read it or knowing anything about it. And when they do attack it, they attack it at its worst. And that bothered me because it's always embarrassing to have my good friends, attacking for the wrong reason.
Mm-hmm.
And this is that, by the way, this is one of the real major reasons in the history of parapsychology why it's still around and why it hasn't profited from constructive, real good criticism.
Right.
It's always been able to dismiss criticism that they get as irrelevant or attacking straw people and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So I decided, okay, I'm going to do it right. And I decided I would try and look at their best efforts. I couldn't read everything, so I contacted parapsychologists themselves, and I said, okay, what would you say is the best, most promising avenue of research in your field? And almost all of them pointed to the Gonsfeld studies. There were then about 40-something Gonsfeld studies that had been done. And I contacted Charles Onaton, who had published the very first Gonsfeld study, and he was so delighted to have the skeptic take them seriously that he decided, he told me he would get me every report of every experiment ever been done on it, including ones that hadn't even been published.
Nice.
And ultimately, he sent me, I think it took him 6 months, but he sent me 600 pages of documents. So I hadn't realized what I was getting myself in for.
Yeah, at that point, I think you kind of reconsidered how Randy and Martin Gardner were doing it, huh?
Right. So I began going over the reading of those, and at first I was quite impressed. You begin reading these things, and each study is getting one significant result after another, and supposedly using good, sophisticated statistics, knowing about controls and everything else, and many of them with PhDs, many of them I knew of, like Irving Child at Yale University and people like that. And so it looked very good, but then I sat down and began reading each study and making a note of what little defects I could find. And I come up with a list of 12 categories I thought I could objectively score, but I wouldn't be able to say they did or did not do the statistical test right. They did or did not use multiple testing without correcting for it. Things like that.
Right.
I come up with 12 categories, and to my horror, I discovered that not one experiment escaped at least one of these categories, and most of them just had, you know, several of them. And most of these categories, I thought, were flaws that parapsychologists and the sounds would say, hey, if you get that flaw, that says that experiment just can't be trusted, you know. Mm-hmm. And that surprised me because many of these people were people I knew. I had some respect for parapsychologists, but they had scientific training, and they and I was surprised that there were so many defects in this body of literature. So I finally wrote up my critique of that whole body of literature. That's the original database, I would call it, 1985, and the General Parapsychology published it, but they held on to my paper for a year, and I wasn't able to change it, while they let Onaton spend time trying to work up his response to it. Mm-hmm. So that whole issue of the General Parapsychology 1985 was devoted to my critique and then Onaton's equally lengthy response to it. I was so upset with his response because it was accusing me of all kinds of things, and of course he had 14 months to play with his response without, and I had no rebuttal. Usually all psychology journals, when you have an argument like that, the original person gets the last word.
Yeah.
So I wrote a very long rebuttal step by step to his thing, and again they sent it off to him. See, they said they would publish my rebuttal, my response to his rebuttal. But they're first going to let him have his chance to respond to it. I met him at that time while he was still playing with my rebuttal, and somehow we went to lunch, and he was almost very upset that I had so maligned him in my rebuttal. I said, mind you, you're the one who maligned me, and you said, you never get around to the book, you know, and you're accusing me of things that you yourself did, you know, that's your fault there. And he was almost like a child, almost like ready to cry almost over it, you know, he was so upset with this. But then I realized by then, too, that what had happened was that all the skeptics, Martin, Randy, but also all the academic skeptics, were all just enthused at my article. They said, boy, you really showed them up. You really destroyed that whole stuff. But all the parapsychologists were saying, boy, Onaton, you know, you showed Ray Hyman up. You destroyed his argument completely. And I realized that not neither side, no one but Chuck Onaton and myself, actually reading all the details and we're looking into the nitty-gritty what we're fighting over. No one else, everyone was taking it for granted that either I was completely right and they would take willing to take my word for it. On the parapsychological side, they weren't going to check out all the things we were fighting over. So at that point, I sat down and I told Chuck, well, maybe we are, we agreed, maybe we'll do a joint paper, because I was surprised that he was agreeing with me in our talk about several things which I didn't realize he would go along with me. For example, he agreed that, yes, no matter how good he thought the original database was, he realized that there were enough problems with it that we could not conclude that there was anything called the ESP or PSI based on the original database. So we did a joint paper on how to replicate it, you know, what would be required for adequate replication, what standards would be needed, and so on. And sure enough, about 1980 or so, he had come up with, he had worked in 6 years of research in his laboratory, and he came up with what's called the Otto-Gonsfeld experiment, which supposedly met all the criteria that he and I had agreed upon and were highly significant. And then Daryl Bem joined him, who's a well-known social psychologist, but decided to support him and use his name on the article, put his name on the article, and they were able to publish in the Psychological Bulletin, which is quite a coup. So he published it, but the editor of the Psychological Bulletin agreed to publish it because Daryl Bem's name was on it, but only if I would write a commentary on it. So I did. And then Bem, by then, Onaton unfortunately had died, but Bem wrote a response to my commentary. Then, the field hasn't stopped yet, because then Weissman, some years later, Weissman and Milton, they did a meta-analysis of all the Gonsfeld studies since the debates between Onaton and myself. And they decided that they all added up to zero effect size, and there was nothing there.
And these are the experiments that allegedly fixed the specific criticisms that you had made to Onaton.
Well, yeah, supposedly. And then, that didn't end there, because then Ben and some parapsychologists got together, and they added some more studies to the Weiss and Milton one, and then they reanalyzed, and they decided there was something there. Mm-hmm. At the same time, Dean Radin, parapsychologist, published his book in 1997 called The Conscious Universe, which, if you want to know the best, strongest argument you can make for parapsychology, that book is it. You know, that has chapter after chapter of meta-analyses with odds of trillion to one, mostly, you know, billions to one or trillion to one, typically, he says, against the possibility of this being a chance. And he does in every area of parapsychology, so it's an overwhelming type of thing. At the same time, Weissman published their stuff. His book came out, and he does a meta-analysis of the Gonsfeld experiments, too, up until 1997. And he concludes that with odds of trillion to one against chance, that they really have been replicated. This is the same time that Weissman and Milton come out with their meta-analysis and said the effect size is zero. There's nothing there.
How are they seeing things so differently? Like,
that was a mystery at first to me. Then I found two things that go on. This is typical of parapsychologists, unfortunately. One thing, of course, is that if you look at the studies they each included, there were some that Weissman and Milton hadn't included in their meta-analysis, and there are some that Radin had omitted and put in, and this made some difference. And that's one of the problems with meta-analysis. It's a very subjective thing, what you include, what you don't include. But the main thing is what I call double-dipping, and this goes on a lot in parapsychology. By double-dipping, I mean they're having their cake and eating it, too. Basically, what he did for his meta-analysis to see whether the studies have been successfully replicated since our debate, he included the studies that we had debated over into his meta-analysis along with the new ones.
Right.
So the ones we are debating, well, we already know that the effect size is big. And as you do that, of course, they're being counted into they raise the effect size. Mm-hmm. I call it double dipping.
Yeah.
This goes on a lot.
Astrologers are famous for that, too.
Right.
You find some random effect, and then you include that in your subsequent data, so it sort of perpetuates either the bad data or the random effect through the alleged follow-up studies. So it sort of poisons the data.
Isn't that also called the file draw effect?
Well, the file draw effect is not including studies that are negative, yeah.
Okay, well, the way they handle the file draw effect, by the way, the parapsychologists are very sophisticated about all these things. They handle the file draw effect by using a correction Robert Rosenthal created. And what they do is they look at the studies that have been published that they have, and they say, okay, how many studies would have to have been in the file drawer which had zero of effect size, right?
Mm-hmm.
And to neutralize what has already been existing. And they usually come up with big numbers, like with the original Gonsfeld studies, there were about 42 studies in the original Gonsfeld database. When they applied this Robert Rosenthal's correction, they decided that it had been something like several hundred, maybe a few thousand studies would be necessary to be in file drop to neutralize those published studies. And because it's so difficult to run an individual Gonsfeld study, they said just it's very implausible that the file drawer effect could apply to this. Several problems with that, of course. One is that the use of just assuming that the ones in the file drawer all have zero effect size is unrealistic because they probably, several of them, would have to have negative effect sizes.
Right.
And they're just leaving that out by chance, you know. And so there's a bias there in effects and that things there. But also, I did my corrections for file drawer stuff like that. It's not that clear cut that this is a good correction, that you can correct it that way anyway. However, that it still means that the existence of a file drawer effect, even if it's small, does add some bias to their effect sizes that they have when they do their meta-analyses.
Right.
The most important thing is a meta-analysis is a stupid thing to do. It confuses what we call confirmatory with exploratory research. A meta-analysis is a good exploratory research type of thing. And to give you one example of how unrobust a meta-analysis is, the very first meta-analysis ever done in parapsychology was me. I did it. I did a meta-analysis on the original Gonzo data body. That's part of my critique of their work. So I did this meta-analysis, and I'm very sorry I did it, because ever since then, all the parapsychologists latched onto it, and the only evidence they have now for any evidence that there might be psi is based on their meta-analyses. Mm-hmm.
So that was all your fault?
What's that? Yes, unfortunately, I did the first one, and then they latched onto it. They latched onto it for a very good reason. Remember, I found all these flaws in their research, and the flaws continue. Arnton published a paper one time saying, look, a flaw is only a flaw if you can demonstrate that it made a difference. So let's say a study used the wrong statistical test, or they used multiple testing, the data mine. You did something that's terribly wrong. Mm-hmm. But unless the critic, the skeptic, by the way, this is another play they like to use, that's putting the onus of the burden of proof on the wrong foot.
Right, right.
It should be on them. They always like to shift it. And so unless the skeptic can, or the critic can show that the flaw really made a significant difference, then it's not a flaw. And that's why I call retrospective sanctification.
So Ray, while we're still talking about ESP, I did want to just step back a little bit, because we get bogged down, I think, a lot in the details of the research, and of course they're all extremely important, but I also think it's helpful to look at ESP research on the whole. And, you know, for me, always one of the big differences has been that ESP research isn't building on itself. It isn't moving forward. Is that your assessment as well?
Yes, I've always said, going back maybe 40 years, I always kept saying that one of the real problems with the field is not cumulative.
Right.
Every generation says, well, let's forget about the early stuff that Ryan did and stuff like that. We know that was bad work. But the new stuff, all right, that's great. The Gonzo was like that. Now, that was the new hope that they had. Mm. And it's still going. Actually, Gonzo's been hanging up longer than many other fields. But they've dropped a lot of areas that were once their big breadwinners. Mm-hmm. They keep changing. And it's not like other fields where it's cumulative. You build on it.
That's right. They're still trying to just demonstrate that the statistical, you know, fluctuations in the data are real. And they're sort of stuck on that first step.
Right. Well, the worse than that, they're the only field I know of that has its premises that they are trying to create anomalies. They're trying to find anomalies. In science, anomalies, by the way, they use this word anomaly,
right,
and they use it in a different way, too. They use every word they use, they take from science and they use it differently.
Yeah, they call it anomalous cognition, right?
Yeah. But in science as a whole, anomaly is a very, very, very well-defined deviation from a theoretical prediction, and you precisely can specify what that anomaly is. For example, when Leverrier was concerned about, and other people concerned about, the orbit of Uranus, he went and rechecked it over and over again. He found a very precise deviation, departure from what it should be according to the Newtonian theory. And
was that Mercury? Move.
No, Mercury was next. But with Uranus, he finally predicted exactly what kind of a planet, that was Neptune, it turned out to be, would have to have its orbit, what size it would have to be, and so on, to reduce that anomaly, to make it no more anomaly. When parapsychologists use anomaly, they just simply mean some sort of departure from chance, which can't be explained at the moment.
Right.
Something weird.
It's an artifact.
Yeah, so it's kind of like an argument from ignorance.
Yes, it's an argument from ignorance, but it's worse than that. It's what I call the patchwork quilt fallacies involved here as well. You know, my favorite example is that Rhine, by the middle 30s, he had created quite a stir, and scientists were interested because he was, for the first time, claiming all kinds of highly significant results with his card-guessing experiments. In the middle of all that, about 5 or 10 years into that, he suddenly announced that he discovered a new effect that shows that psi is real, you know, the ESP is real, and that was the decline effect. Well, he'd gone back and looked at his own and other parapsychologists' experiments and found that in many cases, he found that the beginning of the experiment, they would have more hitting than they should be getting, and at the end of the experiment, they would have less hitting than you would expect. And when you put them together, you usually got just average around chance, and that's why people weren't getting as many successful results as they should be. Mm-hmm. So he declared that, and he said, since no one was looking for that decline effect, that that was a real effect. Now, it turns out that afterwards, not many people were finding decline effects, but that didn't bother them. If they didn't get a decline effect, they got an incline effect. That was good, too.
Mm-hmm.
If they didn't get an incline effect or a decline effect, but if they got something else that was significant, that was fine as well. Which meant that since they don't specify, there's nothing that can... They have no positive theory what psi should be.
Right.
They can't tell you when psi is not there. So any glitch is grist for their mill. And that's still the way they are today, too. They can't predict what's going to happen. And if you don't get anything, that's fine, too, because that means that there is what's called a psi-conducive conditions, and they don't know what they are, and psi and conditions that don't allow it to happen. So they're in a wonderful situation that nothing can disconfirm their findings. They get something, even if it wasn't what they predicted, as long as it's a deviation from chance, that's okay. That's another sign of psi. Now, this gets to ridiculous proportions, because when I reviewed the Otto Ganfeld experiments that Ben and Arnerton published in the Psychological Bulletin, I found some very peculiar things in the data, and which indicated to me that there was a real artifact going on there. And Ben's response to my finding of this peculiar peculiarity in the data was, hey, if this holds up, this could be another effect of psi, and we're going to name it the Hyman effect.
Right.
Oh, God.
Any anomaly is a new effect.
This is called the patchwork quilt fallacy, that anything that happens can be claimed as a sign of psi. And if it doesn't happen next time, it's okay. Something else could be claimed as a sign for psi.
Why does it always have to be like these little anomalies and stuff? I want someone to read my
mind.
That's
all they got, Jay.
Read
my
mind.
That's all they
got. Yeah, but you know, like it's somebody should just stand up one day and say, enough with these little anomalies and all that crap. Read my mind. Like, do something significant.
Well, that's a big part of it, is that they're going through all of these tests, and in the end, even in the best of possible worlds, what they've got is a very, very, very tiny effect that doesn't really mean anything.
That could only exist in very peculiar research conditions, right?
Yeah.
By the way, significant sounds like an interesting term. It's a bad term to have used because it sounds like it's something meaningful, right? Significant.
Yeah.
Right.
All it means is that you got a result that's low probability. The problem there also is that they rarely, since they don't specify too clearly in advance exactly the whole, what I call the outcome space, you don't know exactly what they were predicting. You don't know how many things they would have looked at ahead of time, so we don't know whether that 5% chance or whatever it was really is 5%, because if you have 100 different things you can latch onto and you test each one at 5%, you got a very high probability at least one of those things you're going to test being significant in that sense.
Right.
So it's interesting that if you go back and read their own literature, as I do, you find that there are papers by parapsychologists. There are two recent ones that I stick in my mind where two major parapsychologists have gone through the data of in every area of parapsychology, like the Ganfeld and stuff like that, and what they find over time, the effect size keeps decreasing,
mm-hmm.
approaching zero. So, and that's true in all the areas that they evaluated. And now you think, they say, uh-oh, that means we're in trouble, that maybe we got nothing. No. What they do is they begin developing the very elaborate theories why psi is different, and that's why that becomes a property of psi, that you find something that's useful, a nice effect size, but over time, it gradually disappears, and so that's another property of psi.
Yeah, it's a shyness effect. It likes to hide from experimenters. They also talk about now the experimenter effect, which means when anyone who's not a true believer does the study or tries to replicate them, they come up with a null effect or a negative result, and that's because you're a non-believer.
Right, even believers, even some of the believers, some major parapsychologists haven't been able to get a significant effect. Some parapsychologists claim our only real finding is the experimenter effect. But think about it, if that's the only real finding, that means that one of the basic premises of other sciences is being abolished, that's the publicness of scientific data.
Right.
That means that only some people, under some conditions, and not even all parapsychologists, are ever going to be able to observe what they're studying, which is very, very weird. By the way, another thing they've liked, there are several sobering things you can raise and say, hey, this is something really bad about this field. To me, the most sobering thing is that parapsychologists always like to say, well, look, you psychologists also have trouble replicating your data, you know, and you have all kinds of problems. We're just as good as you guys are in some ways. Mm-hmm. Well, counter to that is simply this, that every field, including psychology, that claims to be a science, every field that claims to be a science, has several of what Kuhn called paradigm experiments. In other words, we have experiments that we can take and give to students and say, new students, you know, say, go do this experiment, you're going to get these results. We have memory experiments, we have perceptual experiments, you name them, we have thousands of them. And every field has this except one field. And that one field is parapsychology.
Right.
They don't have a single experiment that they can give anyone and say, go do this and you'll get that. But every other field has thousands of them.
Right.
That already means, hey, this is a very special field.
Right. Well, that pattern is very familiar to skeptics who deal with these topics, and that's the pattern you see when there's no real phenomenon at the core of the research, when the research is basically looking for something that doesn't exist. And we see that in, you know, homeopathy, we see it in dowsing, we see it in, you know, multiple paranormal fields. You see the exact same thing. The same patterns, the better the experiments get, the smaller the effect size, and it tends to vanish to zero as the experimental design evolves.
The problem here is that the parapsychologists, I always want to see, to me, the fascinating thing about me being in a field like this is that most of these parapsychologists, almost all of them, have a PhD of some sort, and some of them have actually made a name in some field.
What a waste of money.
I'm always fascinated by how these people can fool themselves, you know, how they can convince themselves of this. They have an explanation for everything, you know, and so everything you just pointed out, all these weaknesses that we're talking about, this then has become the property of science, and they're using their smarts to outsmart themselves.
Yeah. Have I also found, and this is definitely true of, again, Marilyn Schlitz, who we had on our show recently, that they really do have a different worldview. And for them, the reason why this little tiny anomaly is important is because if it's real, that means the paranormal universe is real. Regardless of how important or big or useful or practical the effect is, it means that all of their belief systems in healing energy, in spirituality, in everything else is justified. It makes everything real to them. And of course, there is a lot of overlap. But again, like Marilyn, who was talking to us about ESP, and he may have a PhD, maybe a serious researcher, but she also believes in a lot of kooky things, a whole suite of kooky things, including, you know, like energy healing. And it's not a coincidence. And yet at the same time, she dismissed our skepticism as what she called an a priori, meaning that, well, we just come from a different paradigm, and that's the only difference between us. We have one paradigm, they have another. It's like, well, it's not the only difference. The difference is in the details of methodology and logic, which I think are clearly lacking in this field.
She swore up and down.
They love these terms, paradigm, and they love all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And of course, they're into all the linguistic aspects as well,
postmodernism in general.
Postmodernism, that type of stuff. Yeah, they buy all this stuff.
It blows my mind that over and over and over again, they keep getting, even at their best fake results that they can come up with, it's so incredibly small and weak that if psi did exist, what good would it be anyway?
Yeah, but again, I think it's the whole point is to validate their worldview, not to say that this is something useful.
Let me defend them against what you said. You said, what use would it be? If, in fact, they could show that there's something in the ESP that's really going on here, it doesn't make any difference whether it has any practical effect or not. It would be very mind-blowing for science as we know it. It'd be a real challenge. So in that sense, you know, if they did find something like that, really was an anomaly in the sense that it couldn't be accounted for by within the framework of the Einstein Newtonian worldview, whatever it is, then I think it would be a challenge to science as we know. It'd be a very serious something that we have to take very seriously.
So are they all racing to be the first one to find something substantial?
Well, now you're touching on another thing too. That's another thing that's going on here. I always used to wonder why, among parapsychologists, they really used to cite one another's work, you know. They uh, and I realize from finally that each one is in it because he or she wants to be the Newton, you know, the one who makes the breakthrough. Mm-hmm. And it's a low, low probability thing. It's like hitting a lottery, I think, the way they look at it, I'm sure.
But what would it take? What would it take to turn these little anomalies into a revolution? You need something else has to change or be added. You just can't take these unpredictable anomalies and say, look, I'm going to change science. What else would have to happen?
Well, Bob, that's a good question. But, you know, there's some sophisticated people in this. That's what's fascinating about the field. There's some very sophisticated people. When I began in psychology, information theory was a big thing, and coding theory, you know, stuff like that. And some of these parapsychologists would be giving you an answer like this. Well, look, it doesn't make a difference how small these anomalies are, how if they're real. Then we can do coding and decode things and stuff like that. You know, you can do redundancy coding, you do other kinds of coding, and you can turn it into something worthwhile. And they buy into, you know, and many of them are into quantum physics and stuff like that. So they're aware of these things. And
Dean Radin has some outrageous theories of what we'll be able to do in a future where everybody can read each other's minds. That's just, it's kind
He's a fascinating guy to me.
That's a really nice way of putting it, Ray.
But what's fascinating about Radin is that he comes through at first as being very sophisticated. He was one of the first to apply what's called neuro programming. I forget what it is, you know, where the computer programs learn on their own, you know, to work out the patterns and stuff like that. And he applied it to an ESP experiment, to Bob John's work on RNG stuff. And he found, sure enough, that when you take the first half of the data and you train the computer program on its first half of the data, it predicts to the second half of the data. So that shows that the data are real, you know, that there's really something like psi or something going on in the data. And to me, what was horrible about it, two things. One was I was fascinated by using a very sophisticated approach, but it took me a little while to realize that when you split data, you already know, if I take a set of data where I know this set of data, this person's data has a higher proportion of hits, this one has lower proportion of hits, and I randomly split it in half, I would expect that both halves are going to have a higher proportion of hits and a lower proportion of hits than the other half and stuff. I'm sure, certainly going to be able to predict from one to the other. But that's another example of double dipping.
Yeah.
You have to predict to new independent data, not to the data like that. And he never did that experiment again. And his whole career has been, now I've gone back and looked at a lot of other stuff he's done in ESP field. And everything he does, he has some very clever, new, novel application of technology and the latest in computer sophistication and so on. And yet, he gets results, and then he never repeats that. That's dropped, and he goes on to other stuff. And as a cynic, you wonder, well, why? What happened there? Why does no one else follow up? Why does he follow up his own great work, right?
Right.
And then I found out some other things. When I went through his presentiment work, I went through and I found, it took me a while to find it, that, hey, he'd done three experiments, each replicated the other. But when I go down to the fancy way that he was correcting for baselines and stuff like that, the correction was one way in one experiment. The second experiment was a different correction. The third experiment was a different correction. And then I realized I did some simulations, and the corrections from the first experiment would almost, and the one in the second experiment would cancel each other out. In other words, who would give you a different result? Mm-hmm. And why would he always changing his corrections? Mm-hmm. And I'm realizing that this is a subtle kind of, maybe unconscious or conscious, I'm not sure which, way of making sure you're going to get what you want from the data.
He's making an ad hoc statistical fix to make the data significant. I mean, we call that cheating, right? I mean, that's basically just fraud, whether it's conscious or unconscious.
Yeah, well, actually, I have enough experience as a statistical consultant to all kinds of people and groups to realize that people do this and fool themselves with stuff. It looks like it's cheating, but
right.
You now can't be sure they literally cheated. I remember being on a program, 2020, opposite Rosemary Altea once, and Lynn Scherer kept asking me, well, is she a fraud? Are you saying she's a fraud? And I said, I don't know whether she's a fraud. All I can say is that if I were a fraud, I would do exactly what she did.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Ray, we are out of time. I hate to say it. It was a lot of fun talking to you.
Thank you. I enjoyed it. I rambled.
That's okay.
It was awesome. I loved it.
There was so much more, actually, I was thinking of asking you that we didn't get to. We'll have to have you back on the show sometime.
So happy to do anytime.
Great. Cool.
All right. Thanks again. Take care.
Thanks, Ray.
Thanks, Ray.
Okay. Bye.
Well, that was great having Ray Hyman on, and he did tell us that this was his first podcast.
Broke his chair.
So we got Ray's first podcast.
Is he awesome or what? But we only scratched the surface with him. We have to have him back.
Yeah, we do. We didn't even talk about cold reading, which is his real ballywick. So we definitely have to have him back.
For Ray, we need like an entire day.
Yeah,
we
right.
need to do a 24-hour podcast and just have Ray
he
talk.
really comes off as an amazingly friendly, intelligent, fun guy. You know,
yeah,
he is
like the good cop of skepticism, which is amazing. Why there's so much venom against him now because he doesn't believe what they want him to believe.
Yeah.
Well, we have time for a science or fiction.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts. Two are genuine and one is fictitious. And then I challenge my esteemed panel of skeptics to decide which one is the fake.
They couldn't come today, but we're here.
But of course, I will encourage you to play along with us. I have a theme for this week. The theme is cosmology.
I guarantee you Bob gets this one right.
I don't know, because I went to hairdressing school, so I think I've got...
Yeah, I was going to say, Becca has an advantage over the rest of us on this
Let's
one.
Let's go.
Ready. Number one. Physicists have discovered a way to cause light to travel backwards.
Oh, come on. That's so stupid.
Item number two. Based upon recent observations of the most distant quasars, physicists have recalculated the age of the universe up from 13.7 billion years to as high as 19 billion years. Item number three, physicists in a recent publication claim to provide evidence for the existence of a contracting universe before the Big Bang. So, light going backwards, recalculating the age of the universe from 13 to 19 billion years, or new evidence of a big crunch before the Big Bang.
Jesus.
Jay, go first.
All right, well, of course I'm going first. What sucks about this, and you in particular, Steve, is that two of them have to be wrong or else I have to kill myself. So, I mean,
oh, you mean you want two of them
two
to be
of them
wrong.
Have to be wrong, man. Yeah, the light traveling backwards makes absolutely no sense to me, but I'm going to just have to say it's possible that it's true because I don't know. The third one has to be false. It has to be. We have no concept of what happened before the Big Bang. None whatsoever. It is blank void, never to be known. That's it. That's my final answer.
So you think number three
final answer. Yeah.
Is incorrect, is fake. Evan.
I'll say that number three is incorrect as well. For basically the same reasons. I don't see how they could have any evidence as to what happened before what is deemed the Big Bang. I just don't understand.
Evan, Steve did say that somebody published that. That could be true. I think I just caught the snag there.
True.
Yeah. He didn't say that. I don't know. I stick with three anyway.
Light traveling backwards seems, not so outrageous. They do talk about teleporting light from one place to another, and I've read about that a little bit. Recalculating the age of the universe from 13 billion to 19 billion.
Sure.
Okay. It seems plausible. So I'll stay with three.
Okay. Rebecca?
Okay. Well, I think that I'm pretty sure I read an article or maybe I heard somewhere the thing about the light traveling backwards. So I think that's true. And number two just seems too plausible. I don't think you would have... I think number two is the fake one because number three is just it's too crazy. You wouldn't have made that up. And it's a cool idea. I like the idea of it. And I think that they could possibly, you know, they're doing crazy things with quantum whatnot. I think that I like to use the technical jargon, you know. I don't mean to speak above the heads of most of our listeners, but
you mean the whole sort of general mishmash?
Quantum thingamajig. So I'm going with number two.
Okay, Bob?
I'll say that, oh, yes, he would make that stuff up. Number one, I could see that happening. They could do some amazing things with light, depending on you know, what media it's propagating in. And, I mean, they've caused it to essentially stop and recreate itself in some experiments. So, yeah, that's – I'd like to read the details about that, but that seems totally plausible to me. Quasar – the universe 13.7 to 19. Wow, I didn't hear about that, and that's a pretty significant leap. And that would have been my choice, except then you said number three, evidence of a contracting universe before the Big Bang. You can't have evidence for that. Relativity and quantum mechanics become nonsensical before, you know, during the conditions of the Big Bang. There's no way you could predict anything before the Big Bang, let alone a few milliseconds after it. So. That's definitely – that can't be true unless you snuck in some weasel word in there that I didn't pick up.
So it's just me then.
Okay.
It's got to
be. All right,
so
three of you, the guys think that evidence before of the Big Crunch before the Big Bang is fake. Rebecca thinks that the revising the age of the universe from 13 to 19 billion years is fake. And you all agree that light could go backwards. You have no problem with the whole – and you, that's we'll do that
wrong.
One. That is true. No, that one is true. And you guys all got it. You know, there are lots of funky quantum mechanical experiments that you could make light do all kinds of things under certain conditions. You could make it seem to go faster than the speed of light, to go slower. And there were actually – it was predicted that you should be able to go – to make light go backwards. And then finally somebody did it. This is Robert Boyd of the University of Rochester.
Yeah.
How do you do it, Steve?
He says, yeah, it's weird stuff. Well, you know, dang if I can understand the actual physics behind
did
this.
Did he say dang?
I think he did.
But
he's from
didn't
Rochester.
Didn't they use fiber optic cables or
oh,
something?
Oh, dang, you betcha. Yeah, it was through – they used fiber optic cables. And what they were able to do is demonstrate that the pulse of light that they were sending through it, and of course they're doing something to modulate the pulse of light, but the pulse actually exits the fiber optic before it actually even enters it. So it actually travels backward from the source, from the receptor to the source. But, of course, like all of these experiments, which appear to make light travel faster than the speed of light or whatever, information is not traveling faster than the speed of light. Information is not traveling backwards. And it's when the laws of relativity really deal with information. But waves can be made to behave or seem to behave in weird ways. So the way they described it is that the light wave, the leading edge of the light wave, it gets to the end of the fiber optic cable first. And that leading edge contains all of the information about the light wave itself. Then the light wave gets sort of reconstituted out of that information at the end of the light wave, and it sends a pulse back to the beginning.
I totally don't get it.
Yeah, there's actually a kind of a neat graphic on the website that you could kind of see that happening.
It's pretty cool.
It's weird, but the bottom line to remember is that they're just sort of making waves do bizarre things, waves of light do bizarre things, but none of these experiments have ever violated the Einstein's, you know, general relativity because special relativity, because the information cannot be transmitted faster than the speed of light, and that's the real law.
Yada, yada, yada. Get to the reveal. Tell us what this is.
All right. So, what's it going to be? Let's talk about physicists in a recent publication claim to provide evidence for the existence of a contracting universe before the Big Bang.
What?
Now, I must admit, I was very skeptical of this one when I
Ha-ha!
First read it. I had to read it, but that one is true.
Evidence on.
Now, the evidence, of course, is all theoretical, but this was published.
Then is it evidence?
It's well, as much as anything is in cosmology.
What did I tell you, Evan?
This was
you said that Becky would get it right. That's
published
what I said
by
too.
Abhay Ashtekar, director of the Institute of Gravitational Physics and Geometry at Penn State University. And he, basically what he's saying is that rather than a Big Bang, there is what he is calling a quantum bounce. I wonder if that term is actually going to take off.
So what you're saying is that it's a quantum thingamajig.
Yes. That,
technically.
You know, he says, we were so surprised by the finding, he added, that the team repeated the calculations for months to include different possible values of some numbers representing the current universe, but the results kept pointing to a bounce. So basically they're extrapolating from the physical laws of the universe to suppose, you know, what might have come before the Big Bang. And their calculations, you know, bear out the model that includes this quantum bounce, and they ran the numbers over and over again, and it keeps coming out that way. So obviously this has to be vetted, and has to, you know, the implications have to, you know, be assessed by other physicists. This is all still highly theoretical.
I feel totally ripped off right now.
But that's what they're claiming.
How do you predict that when you don't even know what happened right after the Big Bang? How do you extrapolate beyond that when you can't even get to the Big Bang? How do you go beyond the Big Bang?
It's got to be a guess.
I don't know. Evidence was just...
The articles that I read did not really convey that. So I could not learn that from the sources that I read.
All right, go ahead, Steve. Go to two. That one sounded pretty wacky, too.
Yeah, I mean, number two I just made up.
Yeah, do you really need an explanation?
You know, as wacky as that was, three was even wackier, and you must have known I would have jumped on that one.
I know. I mean, three was the bait here. Right. But you guys are right. I mean, saying anything about what happened before the Big Bang certainly seems to defy logic. But this is a method of, again, extrapolating from the way the universe is now. And again, I don't think that you could probably understand it unless you're a theoretical physicist who understands, you know, multidimensional differential calculus. So
all right, let's get him on and interview him.
Yeah, we have to some degree just see what does the scientific community have to say about this. But again, the item was that there was a paper published claiming this. So, Rebecca is the sole victor.
Yay.
This week.
I give you props, Rebecca.
As was predicted by both Jay and Ed.
You did very good, Rebecca. I admit it.
Thank you.
You get a half.
But it means I have to try harder next week.
No, Steve, you did pretty good this week because I would have bet hard cash on this one.
I do try to make it challenging, but it is fun. And Rebecca does get props for getting two in a row correct. So thanks again for joining me. It was a good show. I enjoyed it, guys.
Me too, Steve.
Good
one.
Likewise.
Ray was fantastic.
Ray was fantastic. And I will say that next week we have James Randi giving us an interview.
The bad cop.
Keep an eye out for that. He's the bad cop of skepticism. Right? We have the good cop. Next week is the bad cop. So look for James Randi next week. And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by the New England Skeptical Society. For information on this and other podcasts, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. Please send us your questions, suggestions, and other feedback. You can use the Contact Us page on our website, or you can send us an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. Theorem is produced by Kinetto and is used with permission. Sleepless nights, slow burn days, problems, proofs, endless delays.